I believe I have a distinction at this Emily Dickinson Festival that no other writer here can claim, and that is that Emily and I have the same birthday. if she'd only been born 5 years earlier, it would have been a perfect 100 years. You notice I don't say if only I'd been born 5 years earlier, but or later, that is. I want to read a couple of Emily's poems that meant a lot to me when I was a young woman, because I thought I was the only person in the world that didn't know who they were. I thought that my shaky identity was unique, and my fear that if I looked in a mirror, I wouldn't see anything there was special to me. And I remember the great comfort with which I found Emily on that subject in the following poems. 470. I am alive, I guess. The branches on my hand are full of morning glory, and at my fingers' end, the carmine tingles warm. And if I hold a glass across my mouth, it blurs it, physician's proof of breath. I am alive because I am not in a room. The parlor, commonly it is, so visitors may come. And this from 351. I felt my life with both my hands to see if it was there. I held my spirit to the glass to prove it possibler. I turned my being round and round and paused at every pound to ask the owner's name for doubt that I should know the sound. 458. Like eyes that looked on wastes, incredulous of aught, but blank and steady wilderness diversified by night. Just infinites of naught as far as it could see. So I looked the face I looked upon, so looked itself to me. I offered it no help because the cause was mine. The misery a compact as hopeless as divine. Neither would be absolved, neither would be a queen without the other. Therefore we perish though we reign. Now I hesitate to look in mirrors for other reasons. But I think I know who I am, and I know who helped. I'm going to read two poems in tribute to two very different women. The first is Mrs. Robert Louis Stevenson, Fanny Osborne, the extraordinary woman that he fell in love with when they were both in rural France studying art, and whom he pursued across the United States, risking his life on, if you've ever read a description of the kind of train he slept on a board, with people blowing cigar and pipe smoke into the face of his tubercular, you'll know it was true love. He nearly died in Monterey, but she nursed him, and various people took care of him, and finally he persuaded her to get a divorce and marry him, and they tried living in Edinburgh and London for a while, where he nearly died. It was not the place for him in those days of incredible smog and coal smoke. So she took him away from his friends to Samoa, where he lived another decade. And his friends, if you've ever read a biography of RLS, never forgave her. She was this divorced vixen who had stolen their darling and his wonderful conversation. I've long been interested in women who are the surrogates of gifted men, the mothers, the daughters, the wives, the sisters. What do they do with their creativity when they're looking after a man's creativity? This is what one woman did. The poem is called Fanny, and I'll read from it because it's quite long. At Samoa, hardly unpacked, I commenced planting. When I'd opened the chicken crates, built the cochins a coop, the Reverend Mr. Claxon called, found me covered with mud, my clothes torn, my hair in a wad, my bare feet bleeding. I had started the buffalo grass in the new-made clearing. The next day, the priest paid a visit, civil but restless. I was dying to plant the alfalfa seed. Gave him a packet. That evening, I paced up and down, dropping melon seeds, tomatoes, and bush lima beans here and there where I thought they would grow. We were short of food now, so I cooked up a mess of fat little parrots, disturbed at the way they suggested cages and swings and stands. An excellent meal. I have been told the dodo survived here and yearned for a pet on a string. Then I built the pig house. I had bought sweet coconut seed from Savage Island. I planted kidney potatoes in small earthen hills, sowed seeds of eggplant in numerous boxed soil, tomato and artichoke too, half a dozen fine pineapple brought over by Mr. Carruthers, the island solicitor. As fast fast as we eat them, we plant the top. The kitchen, a shack near the house. I made bread in the rain. October, 1890. I've been here nearly a month. Put in corn, peas, onions, radishes, lettuce. Lima beans are already coming up. The ripening cantaloupe were stolen. Carruthers gave me mint root and granadilla like a bouquet. He delivered a load of trees, two mangoes among them. I set them out in the heavy rain, then rounded off the afternoon sowing Indian corn. Louis has called me a peasant. How I brooded, confided it to you, diary, then crossed it out. Peasant because I delve in the earth I own, confiding my seed and root. I too a creator. My heart melts over a bed of young peas. A blossom on the rose tree is like a poem by my son. My hurt healed by a cord. I go on planting. No one else works much. The natives take it easy. The colonials keep their shops and a shortage of customers. The mail comes four times a month and the gossip all day. The bars are crowded with amateur politicians. Office seekers I name the earwig council and king. Big talkers with small-time conspirators drinking them in. Mr. Carruthers and I picked a site for the kitchen garden. I was planting a new lot of corn and pumpkin when a young chief arrived, laden with pineapple plants. I set them out as I talked to him on the way home. Rat and a wild hen ate the corn. Lettuce got too much sun, so I dug a new patch up the road. In the fragrant evening, I confided to Louis, a puff of the sweetest scent blows back as I cast away a handful of so-called wheat. It still hurts, his remark that I have the soul of a peasant. My vanity, like a newly felled tree, lies prone, bleeding. I clear the weeds near the house for planting maize. Sweet corn and peas are showing. I send for more seed. I clean out the potatoes, which had rotted in their hills. Of course, RLS is not idle. He is writing a footnote to history. How the great powers combine to carve up these islands. I discovered the ylang-ylang tree, a base for perfume, though it suggested to me the odor of boots. Another tree is scented like pepper and spice, and one terrible tree, I am forced to say, smells like ordure. It nearly made me ill. Breadfruit is plentiful. I found a banana grove, began clearing it instantly and worked until I was dizzy. The garden looks like a graveyard, bed shaped like tombs. I plant cabbage, which I loathe, so the British won't tease me for not growing it. But behold, in the hedge among citron and lime, many lemon trees in full bearing. Still, I will fall to brooding for the mirror, though Louis says he finds the peasant class interesting. He is 40 today. I am 10 years his senior. On the cleared land, the green mummy apple, male and female, is springing up everywhere. I discover wild ginger, turmeric, something like sugar, roots of orange, breadfruit, and mango. Seeds of cacao came with a shipment from Sydney. Also 11 young navel orange trees. The strawberry plants are rotten. I am given a handful of beef. I plant more pineapple. All fall I am cursed with asthma, rheumatics, a painful ear, Christmas, a hurricane, and the new year begins. Louis describes it divinely to Henry James. Mr. Carruthers' gift pineapple starts to fruit. I set out one precious rhubarb plant, pause to gloat at the ripe tomatoes, the flourishing long-potted beans, but the neighbor's horses break in and trample the corn. Sometimes, when planting, a strange subterranean rumble, volcanic, vexes the earth beneath this peasant haunch. I rise up from the furrow, knuckle smooth my brow, as I sniff the air, suddenly chemical, a sulfurous fume. Louis insisted on going to Sydney, fell ill again. His mother comes back with him, finds me on my knees. The old lady's heart leaps. Alas, I am planting, not praying. We both rise at 5:30 after dreaming of weed. I'm going to skip a honk here. For 2 months, I misplaced this diary. War is in the air, talk of killing all white. I bought coffee trees, rose trees, and Indian beans, then went to Fiji to rest and get more seeds from a Kew gardener. An Indian in a shop told me how to raise Persian melon and cauliflower and a radish that turns into a turnip when it grows up. I come home to a burgeoning world. Cacao, custard squash, the new house finished and painted peacock blue. The jealous old cat bit off the new cat toes. My mother-in-law returned with her Bible and lady's maid. My daughter, her family, and my son Lloyd came too. The relatives had a terrible row. Mrs. S. refused to pray with servants. I throw up my hands. My diary entries grow farther and farther apart. I wrote, life was a strain. Later, someone crossed it out. In pain again from an aneurysm inside my head, I planted more and more cacao in a form of cherry tree, tobacco, and rubber taught how by Mr. Sketchley. I planted more cacao through an epidemic of flu. 300 seeds in baskets broke through the ground. I get almost no time to write. I've been planting. 4 kinds of cabbage are doing very well. Mr. Haggard, the land commissioner, come to dine, points out a weed which makes excellent eating cooked like asparagus. I shall try it very soon. No, when the Reverend Mr. Claxton comes to call, I refuse to see him. I am tired of the Claxton. The political situation grows grim. I rage at Louis, who toasts her blessed majesty the queen, then aggressively throbbing, turns to my American son, and to say he may drink to the president afterwards, if he likes. I am writing this down, hoping Louis will see it later and be ashamed of his childishness and bad taste. This will be erased. Because war is near, the Germans stop growing cacao. Captain Humpfnagel offers me all the seeds I can use. So now we're blazing with cacao fever, the whole family infected. 600 plants set out, the veranda tracked with mud, the cacao litter, Mrs. S. upset by the mess. 1,200 cacao planted. Joe, my son-in-law, planted his 1,000th tree today. The tree onions make large bulbs but don't want a seed. Most vigorous, sunflower, watermelon, weed. The jelly from berries out of the bush is delicious. Lovely perfume from Massoy, citron, vanilla, and gum. The peanuts are weeded while Joe plays on his flute. I plant cabbage by moonlight, set out more cacao. The heart of a death's head moth beats a tattoo in my head. Planted coffee all day and breadfruit, 5 beauties. Planted coffee the better part of the day, 8 plants. In the nursery, 3 times that many. Planted coffee, painted the storm shutters, planted coffee all morning. I found a heap of old bones in a bush near the sty. 2 heads and a body. A warrior died with his prize. Louis gave the bones a funeral and a burial. A series of hurricanes. Louis writes to the Times of the foul colonial politics. I send to New York for seeds, Southern Cross cabbage, eggplant, sweet potato, and 2,000 custard apples. Louis's own seed, David Balfour, is growing. I wrote nothing from June till the end of the year. Too busy planting. The Samoan princes are getting nearer to war. It pains me to write this. My son-in-law has gone native in a spectacular way. Belle is divorcing. Austin, my grandson, is at school in Monterey. I have not, I believe, mentioned Miss Stevenson recently. She has gone back to Scotland. The first breadfruit bore. Belle and I go on sketching expeditions to the hostile Samoan camps. Stop in town for ginger beer. Mr. Haggard begged to stay in town because he bitterly wanted women to protect. I suggested to him that I and my daughter could hide under his table and hand him cartridges at the window to complete the romantic effect. It is clear that Mr. Haggard is Ryder's brother. He said, you'd sell your life for a bunch of banana trees. I'd given permission to most of the boys to go to the races. Lloyd has put up the lawn tennis thing. Mr. Gurr, the neighbor, rushes in to say war has begun. We all race at a mission. 11 heads have been taken. Later, Mr. Dine's cousin received a head smeared with black. The custom is to return them to the bereaved. He washed it off and discovered it was his brother. He sat there holding his brother's head in his hands, kissing it, bathing it with his tears. A scandal arose because the heads of 3 girls had been taken as well, unheard of before in Samoa, returned wrapped in silk to their kin. At Mali, the warriors danced a headhunter's pantomime. The men who had taken heads carried great lumps of raw pork between their teeth, cut in the semblance of head. I stopped writing this. Too hysterical with migraine. Also, people find where I hide it and strike things out. Our favorite chief is exiled for life. The war winds down. Louis works on his masterpiece, The Weir of Hermiston. Well, I've kept him alive for 8 more years, while his dear friends would have condemned him to fog and rain, so they might enjoy his glorious talk in London, though it be the end of him. Fine friends, except for James. Later. At 6, Louis helped with the mayonnaise. When he put both hands to his head, said, oh, what a pain. Do I look strange? I said, no, not wanting to frighten him. He was never conscious again. In 2 hours, he died. Tonight, the chiefs with their axes are digging a path to the top of the mountain. They will dig his grave. I will leave here as soon as I can and never return, except to be buried beside him. I will live like a gypsy in my wild, ragged clothes until I am old, old. I will have pretty gardens wherever I am. but never breadfruit, custard apple, granadilla, cacao, pineapple, ylang-ylang, citron, mango, cacao. Never again succumb to the fever of plants. This is a new poem called Gerda. You will see certain correspondence here. I will read you the epigraph and see how many of you understand it. Good som haver barn and car, say till mig som liten ar, vart jag mig I varden vander, star min lika I gud hander. It's an old Swedish children's prayer, roughly the equivalent of Now I Lay Me. Down the long curving walk you trudge to the street, stoop-shouldered in defeat, a cardboard suitcase in each hand. Gerda, don't leave, the child cries from the porch, waving and weeping. Her stony mother speaks again of the raise in salary denied. Gerda demands $10 more than the 25 a month she has been paid to cook, sew, keep house, dress and undress the child. Bathe the child with the rough, scaly hands she cleans in Clorox. Sing to the child in Swedish. Teach her to pray, to count her toes in Swedish. 40 years on, the child still knows how in Sweden is a great hit with children under 7, singing a folk song, praying, counting toes. For $25 a month in 1933, Gerda makes for the child her favorite Fatima. A mix of flour, milk, and eggs. You cut in strips, then fry in fat, then dust with sugar. The child helps Gerda cook, so she knows that. In Stockholm, the child will inquire of Fatima, but like lost Gerda, it does not exist. Deep in the depression, the child is aware as Gerda trudges down the walk 4 blocks to the bus, then the train to Minneapolis. What will she do? Gerda, trained as a nurse, found no work before she came to us. $25 a month to sew a quilt for the child, covered with fabulous animals, feather-stitched in blue and white. Now, after 50 years, it hangs on the wall of the child's grandchild in a Chicago house. Then, when the child awoke, addled and drunk with nightmare, she dragged the quilt from her cot, stumbled sniffling into Gerda's room to be taken into her bed, soothed back to sleep by the rough antiseptic hands. The child wakes up to naked light. Ageless Gerda's steel gray bob shakes into place. She owns no mirror. Blind Gerda gropes for her steel-rimmed spectacles as the child sees with fascinated love the curd in the corner of each of Gerda's eyes. It is a magic substance the child has improvised on a favorite tale, Hans Christian Andersen's Snow Queen. She thinks of it as the good cream curd, the reverse of the splinter in the eye of little Kay. Everyone like the brave child in the story, everyone like Gerda. Modest Gerda dresses in the closet. Then the two on tiptoe steal to the child's room so the stout, handsome mother will not waken. Then Gerda bathes the child, scrubs her hard all over with the loofah, dries her carefully in the big warm towel, pulls on her panties of white cotton, then the dress smelling deliciously of Gerda's iron, the dress Gerda smocked at night while the household slept, then the pastel sweater Gerda knitted her. The child sits on the edge of the bed while Gerda brushes then twists the child's fair hair into 2 fat braids secured with rubber bands. The child, so much fairer than her parents, nearly believes she's Swedish, is pleased then and 40 years on to be taken for Scandinavian, Gerda's own. Now Gerda pulls up the white anklets, fastens the sandals, down to the pantry where the child climbs into her chair. Gerda set 3 places, one for the child, one for the child's imaginary playmate, one for her, and they eat the lovely oatmeal Gerda cooked the night before. 30 years on, her father will remark, "Your mother was jealous, so we let her go. Of course I could have raised her wages. Gerda ran the house. The child's throat fills with bile as casually he continues, I always let your mother decide these matters. Of course he did. What did he know of the child's need or passion? The busy lawyer with a neurotic wife whom to placate was easiest. Anything to keep the peace. So he let Gerda leave the house, the yard, the garden, the child's home, long torn down, a place that no longer exists. 35 years on, the child stumbles among the weeds in search of the path down which her Gerda walked, or the porch where the child once stood, bereft. It must have been then that the ice house dream began, her first and last recurring dream. The child stands in a little room of ice, all ice, wall, ceiling, floor. As the dream commences, a song begins outside, impossibly nostalgic, grieving for the lost world before her birth, played on a concertina or harmonium. As the tune goes on, slowly, slowly, the walls move in, the ceiling presses down. The child is enclosed in a kind of upright coffin of milky, iridescent ice. There's no fear. Instead, the child, entranced by a vision of green hills and pure blue skies without, conceives freedom and flight. Also, she knows the last time she had the dream, she forgot the tune on waking. This time, she will not. Fiercely, she concentrates as the ice moves in to touch her on every side and on her head. As the last haunting note is played, the child wakes up. Of course, the tune is gone. It is always gone. For 10 years, the child nurtures a secret plan. At last, she boards a train for the east, waits for the layover in Minneapolis, hurries to a payphone armed with chain, opens the directory, faints to see four columns closely printed of Gerda Johnson. How could there be more than one? Ranging her nickels on the metal counter, she calls from the top as the hands of the clock spin round. Gerda, Gerda, half a page with answers none, or ancient whispering Norse voices down a tunnel of years and oceans cross and cold home villages abandoned long ago. Then she runs out of change and time, a train to catch. She weeps at terminated hope, nourished so long, as the old film strip runs again. Gerda, you trudge down the walk forever. The child, no matter how she calls and cries, cannot catch up. Now, from another life, she summons you, out of the earth or ether, wherever you are. Gerda, come back to nurse your desolate child. Thank you.
I think we need a few minutes of just...
I'll read some of it anyway. We'll see how it goes. Pro Femina, part one. From Sappho to myself, consider the fate of women. How unwomanly to discuss it. Like a noose or an albatross necktie, that clinical sobriquet hangs us codpiece coveters. Never mind these epithets. I myself have collected some honeys. Juvenal set us apart in denouncing our vices, which had grown, in part, from having been set apart. Women abused their spouses, cuckolded them, even plotted to poison them. Sensing behind the violence of his manner, think I'm crazy or drunk, his emotional stake in us. As we forgive Strindberg and Nietzsche, we forgive all those who cannot forget us. We are hyenas, yes, we admit it. While men have politely debated free will, we have howled for it. Howl still, pacing the centuries, tragedy heroines. Some who sat quietly in the corner with their embroidery were Defarges, stabbing the wool with the names of their ancient oppressors who ruled by the divine right of the male. I'm impatient of interruptions. I swear there were millions of mutes for every Saint Joan or Sainted Jane Austen who, vague-eyed and acquiescent, worshipped God as a man. I'm not concerned with those cabbage heads, not truly feminine, but neutered by labor. I mean real women like you and like me. Freed in fact, not in custom, lifted from furrow and scullery, not obliged now to be the pot for the annual chicken. Have we begun to arrive in time? with our well-known respect for life, because it hurts so much to come out with it, disdainful of sovereignty, national honor, and other abstractions, we can say, like the ancient Chinese, successive waves of invaders, relax and let us absorb you. You can learn temperance in a more temperate climate. Give us just a few decades of grace to encourage the fine art of acquiescence, and we might save the race. Meanwhile, observe our creative chaos, flux, efflorescence, whatever you care to call it. I suppose I should say this was written 20 years ago, so some lines that seemed strikingly original to me then now seem less so. I was what you might call a premature feminist, you know, like being a premature anti-fascist. Then I read Simone de Beauvoir and everything I'd ever felt, all those wounds I had sustained when I'd read about men this and men did that and poet key and so on, were all my pains and doubts were confirmed by that great book. Two, I take as my theme the independent woman, independent but main. Observe the exigent neckties, choking violet writers, the sad slacks of stipple-faced matrons, indigo intellectuals, crop-haired and callous-toed, cute spectacles, chewed cuticles, paced out by full-time beauties in the race for a man, retreating to drabness, bad manners, and sleeping with manuscripts. Forgive our transgressions of old gallantries as we hitch in chairs, light our own cigarettes, not expecting your care, having forfeited it by trying to get even. But we need dependency, cosseting, and well-treatment. So do men sometimes. Why don't they admit it? We will be cows for a while because babies howl for us, be kittens or bitches who want to eat grass now and then for the sake of our health. But the role of pastoral heroine is not permanent, Jack. We want to get back to the meeting. Knitting booties and brows, tartars or termagants, ancient fertility symbols chained to our cycle, released only in parts by devices of hygiene and personal daintiness, strapped into our girdles, held down yet uplifted by man's ingenious constructions, holding coiffures in a breeze, hobbled in swathes and whimsy, tripping on feminine shoes with fool heels, losing our lipsticks, you, me, in ephemeral stockings, clutching our handbags and packages. Our masks always in peril of smearing or cracking, in need of continuous check in the mirror or silverware, keep us in thrall to ourselves, concerned with our surfaces. Look at man's uniform drabness, his impersonal envelope, over chicken wrists or meek shoulders, a formal, hard-fibered assurance. The drape of the male is designed to achieve self-forgetfulness. So, sister, forget yourself a few times and see where it gets you. Up the creek, alone with your talent, songs, everything else, you can wait for the menopause and catch up on your reading. So primp, preen, prink, pluck, prize your flesh, all posturings, all ravishment, all sensibility. Meanwhile, have you used your mind today? What pomegranate raised you from the dead, springing full grown from your own head, Athena? Well, might as well go for broke. I will speak about women of letters, for I'm in the racket. Our biggest successes to date, old maids to a woman. And our saddest conspicuous failures, the married spinsters on loan to the husbands they treated like surrogate fathers. Think of that crew of self-pitiers, not very distant, who carried the torch for themselves and got first-degree burned. The sad sonneteers, Toast and Teasdales, we loved at 13. Middle-aged virgins seducing the puerile anthologist through lust of the mind. Barbiturate-drenched Camilles with continuous periods murmuring softly on sofas. When poetry wasn't a craft, but a sickly effluvium, the air thick with incense, musk, and emotional blackmail. I suppose they reacted from an earlier womanly modesty when too many girls were scabs to their stricken sisterhood, impugning our sex, staying good with the men, commencing their insecure bluster. How they must have swaggered when women themselves endorsed their own inferiority. Vestals, vassals, and vessels rolled into several. They took notes in rolling syllabics in careful journals, aiming to please a posterity that despised them. But we'll always have traitors who swear that a woman surrenders her supreme function aggression by equating art with aggression and failure with femininity. Still, it's just as unfair to equate art with femininity like a prettily packaged commodity when we are the custodians of the world's best-kept secret, merely the private lives of one half of humanity. But even with masculine dominance, we mayors and mistresses produced some sleek sabatouses, making their cracks, which the porridge-brained males of the day were too thick to perceive, mistaking young hornets for perfectly harmless bumblebees. Being thought innocuous rouses some women to frenzy. They try to be ugly by aping the ways of the male and succeed. Swearing, sucking cigars, and scorching the bedspread. Slopping straight shots, eyes blotted, vanity blown in that expectation of glory, she writes like a man. This drives other women mad in a mist of chiffon. One poetess draped her gauze over red flannel, a practical feminist. That was Sarah Teasdale, by the way. But we're emerging from all that, more or less. What an opposite I was. We're emerging from all that, more or less, except for some ladylike laggards and quarterly priestesses who flog men for fun and kick women to maim competition. Thank you, Mary McCarthy, and your review of Margaret Atwood. Now, if we struggle abnormally, we may almost seem normal if we submerge our self-pity in disciplined industry. If we stand up to be hated and swear not to sleep with editors. If we regard ourselves formally, respecting our true limitations without making an unseemly show of trying to unfreeze our assets. Keeping our heads and our pride while remaining unmarried, and if wedded, kill guilt in its tracks when we stack up the dishes and defect to the typewriter, and if mothers believe in the luck of our children, whom we forbid to devour us, whom we shall not devour, and the luck of our husbands and lovers who keep free women. Thank you.